Welcome to RCGP Scotland Presents Generally Speaking. In this, the eighth episode of the podcast, RCGP Scotland Chair Dr. Chris Provan and Dr. Rachel Phillips discuss an upcoming mini-series, Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the busy coalface of general practice to consider how GPs can talk to patients about the harms of alcohol.
Welcome to Generally Speaking. Today we have with us Dr. Rachel Phillips, who's going to talk with us about the work around the Scottish Health Action on Alcohol Problems, a really, really important subject area that we all have contact with in our daily practice, absolutely. So, Rachel, can I ask you, first of all, just to tell us about the project you're working on with SHAP and with ourselves in the college?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me, Chris. I'm really happy to be here. For the last year, I've been doing a little bit of work on the side of my clinical practice with a project with RCGP Scotland and SHAP, which is Scottish Health Action for Alcohol Problems. For those people who might not have heard of SHAP, it was set up almost 10 years ago now by doctors from different specialties in different medical colleges who had been seeing increasing alcohol harm in their clinics and wanted to have a bigger voice in the kind of upstream of their patients and national policy. So I've really enjoyed working for them, actually. And this has been a little bit of work really making some educational material, both a webinar for GP trainees throughout Scotland, and also a podcast series that we're hoping GPs and practice nurses will listen to when they're doing the dishes or walking the dog.
Absolutely. I love a podcast while I'm doing the dishes or walking the dog. And that's really the good point of these things is to be able to learn like that and just communicate what we're doing, because it's a really, really important area. We have other contacts with SHAP around policy and minimum unit pricing and all those types of things, which are really important.
Yes.
For Scotland and its relationship with alcohol and prevention and all these types of things.
Yeah.
But why did you in particular decide to concentrate on this role with SHAP?
Well, the truth is, when I first saw the job advertised, I thought, well, I'm definitely not applying for that. I mean, imagine trying to educate GPs on alcohol harms and reduce stigma. I mean, that just sounds like a nightmare job. So I didn't apply first time round, but it obviously lodged with me. And when it became available again, I applied. And I think it's because it's something that I found really difficult in the first few years of my training and working as a GP. And I felt very out of my depth. And I suppose when you find something difficult, you have to work a bit harder at it, and then it gets a bit more satisfying. I remember being a GP ST1, a few weeks in, a female patient confided in me that she was drinking 3 bottles of wine a night.
Right.
And this was in the context of significant childhood trauma.
Yeah.
And I hadn't a Scooby. You know, I think like everyone listening, I didn't have any problem empathizing and feeling motivated for her, but I genuinely just didn't really know how to help her. And I went to one of the senior GPs in the practice and asked for advice. And she said, well, nothing is going to improve here until she stops drinking. And of course, what that patient needed was she needed someone who wasn't shocked, who was informed, who knew how to signpost with conviction to the right places and help build her what they call recovery capital, the internal and external resources that she has to make a change and to have agency. It's taken, I'm still learning, I'm still making so many mistakes, but the very patients who used to sort of terrify me and overwhelm me are becoming a great source of job satisfaction. And so I thought, yeah, I will apply for that.
So is there anything else why this is just generally an important area, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, whether you take data from either self-reporting on alcohol consumption or whether you look at alcohol sales in Scotland and divide it by the population, the numbers come out that about one in five Scots are drinking to harmful levels. So that by that, I mean over 14 units of alcohol a week. So that means that one in five, we could say, patients coming through the door, probably even more because they're now patients, that we see every day are coming to harm from alcohol. And, you know, my example that I just told you is a really extreme example of someone drinking a huge quantity and with trauma in their background. But actually, what I'm hopefully conveying to the students that I've been making presentation for, alcohol harms are not always so obvious. You know, lots of us don't realize that one in 10 breast cancers are caused by alcohol.
Right.
Alcohol is a carcinogen, and we don't really talk about that because of the alcohol industry. And also, I suppose it's not something we want to think about too much. So it's been really interesting learning about all the different harms that alcohol causes, whether it be in young people through accidents, assaults, mental health issues, road traffic, whether it be through in middle-aged people with alcohol liver disease, cardiovascular, and then cancers as we get older. And it's something that we probably just don't think about even as doctors, let alone talk about with our patients.
Yeah, certainly my experience when we do alcohol brief interventions, you know, when you actually ask people about how much alcohol, often they think that what they're drinking is normal, if I can put it that way. But actually you have to point out to them that it's not, and there's evidence that, you know, GPs asking about it, people will think about that.
And it's probably how we ask. You know, SHAP did some qualitative research a few years ago with folk in recovery, and it's a bit uncomfortable reading it because one of the main sort of hurdles that folk reported was a feeling of healthcare stigma from A&E staff and from GPs, from health workers and practices. They got a feeling from us, unfortunately, that we found them, you know, sort of time wasters, bringing on problems on themselves. And a lot of folk even sadly described, you know, a reluctance to consult for a non-alcohol related health problem because they felt that they were being judged for their alcohol problems. So that's really why SHAP wanted to do a bit more sort of outreach and education. But of course, you know, none of us are going to sign up to watch a webinar on stigma, you know, when it's explicit like that. We don't want to be preached at. We're actually doing our best, trying to be kind, and we're exhausted. And so it's really been quite a creative challenge to think, well, what is the basis of our stigma, even when we're well-intended, and how can we address that? And I think being informed helps. I think being exposed to really positive stories of recovery is really crucial. You know, being a GP, we tend to see people who are in crisis or have a problem. That's why they come to us. Yep. We're not seeing the success stories. And how do we get exposed to those success stories to realize that it's possible and that there is this hope, you know, let alone then convey it to our patients? So, you know, that's really what the kind of remit was. How can we improve our consultations and conversations with patients about alcohol? And I think it's about being informed, about holding some hope, and then some really practical tips about, you know, how to bring it up and what to then do when people reveal how much they're really drinking.
Yeah, I mean, the GP consultation is a fascinating thing, really. And I think it's really important that we know how to approach these type of issues and patients feel comfortable with it. So who do you have on your podcast? Who's coming to help us?
Well, we start off with an interview with Dr. Alistair McGilchrist and Dr. Peter Rice. Dr. Rice was the initial head of SHAP, and now it's Dr. McGilchrist. Dr. Rice was a psychiatrist working in addictions, and Dr. McGilchrist, people might recognise, he was a hepatologist here in Edinburgh. And really that episode is setting the scene here in Scotland. We do talk a little bit about the minimum unit price that you've mentioned, a little bit of the politics and the policy, and really the extent of alcohol harm in Scotland and the sort of general context, especially post-COVID, what's been happening to our numbers post-MUP, but also post-COVID. Then we go on and I interviewed someone I've been wanting to meet for ages. He's called Dr. Adam Burley.
Right.
He is a consultant clinical psychologist at the River Centre here in Edinburgh. I'd heard about his work by attending RCGP conferences and hearing people like Kerry Lunan, you know, talk about him. And I feel like he's just got so much insight to offer us in relational injury, the kind of reasons why people might be drawn to alcohol in the first place, the very reasons which then might make people difficult to help as well. So he kind of brings in a psychological kind of angle that is actually quite challenging, you know, for us GPs and in busy practices. I also was delighted to speak to Dr. Claire Gordon, who's a medical consultant at the Western General, who is helping run Milestone. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I have, yes.
For those who don't, it's inpatient residential rehab for people with alcohol-related brain damage. And I spoke to her and Dr. Stephen Smith, another psychologist, about their work there. Again, highlighting ARBD, something I hadn't really heard about until a couple of years ago, how we recognize it, what we can do about it. And the main take-home message is that people can actually recover. They can recover brain function if they stop drinking, which is also important to know. And then finally, I was really happy to speak to Dr. McCartney, a GP who led LEAP. And so we talked a lot about community of practice when it comes to recovery. And then he was also, you know, good enough to share his own lived experience. And again, just hearing his story of recovery, I hope, is something really inspiring to us.
So we've talked about the difficulty with people trusting GPs or medical staff and these things because of their previous experience.
Yes.
Is there any way that we can actually help with that, do you think?
Yeah, I think that was one of the big sort of challenges that came out of my chat to Dr. Adam Burley, that actually he really helps explain that relational injury that some folk have in their early lives is really deep and severe and not necessarily easy to see. So when you see someone paralyzed, you can see the extent of their spinal injury is clear. But a lot of these folk have really severe relational injuries in their early lives. And I found my conversation with him really challenging, actually, in a good way, to realize that. And, you know, something he challenges us on is this dependency phobia. You know, I don't know about you when you were training, but, you know, I very much was given the kind of feeling that it's a poor GP who makes their patients dependent on them.
Yeah.
And that's an ego thing. And, you know, patients need to be able to cope whether you're there or not. And while there's a lot to be said for, you know, if you do your job well, then they'll never even realize or remember you, hopefully. I think for some people, that's not true at all, that they didn't learn dependency as a mother tongue. And they have to learn it as a second language as an adult. And actually that we might be in that privileged position to help that. You know, this idea that dependency is a bad thing, that's a fallacy. I mean, although we might consider ourselves functioning professionals, we're highly dependent on the people in our lives, on my bicycle, on holidays, on music. And that's not a bad thing. And some folk didn't learn healthy dependence. And so allowing people to be and experience a little bit of dependency with us is part of the medicine. I think that was very challenging.
Yeah. And do you think providing continuity of care, is that effective?
Absolutely. You know, and I think continuity is interesting, isn't it? Because you can have continuity of care with a practice. You know, if a practice are all kind of united and singing off the same hymn sheet, then you could have very good continuity with a group of clinicians. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be with an individual. And for some folk who've got straightforward and urgent health problems, it would be more important to them to access someone quickly, doesn't matter who it is. But for the kind of folk who might end up struggling with addiction, who have been using alcohol as a dependence because they didn't have healthy dependence growing up, then actually continuity with one or two GPs who get to know them over time and as humans is exactly, you know, the very thing that they need might be the very thing that we fear.
Yes, I mean, that fits to a certain extent with going to the Deep End conference and hearing them talk about the adverse childhood events and the impact it has. It can be difficult because of the kind of burden on the GP, but it's getting that balance right.
Thinking
about how we do that.
And actually, you know, Adam was very clear about, you know, understanding the pressures that we're under and that a GP consult is very different from a clinical psychologist, what they can offer. And he was very quick to acknowledge that. It wasn't about sort of criticizing us for not being caring enough. In fact, actually understanding the extent of relational injury in a way helps us be kinder to ourselves as GPs. And when you realize the extent of injury someone has, it helps you realize how small what you can offer is, really. And, you know, it helps you understand the behavior that's going on or the counter transference, very difficult feelings that we might experience, as well as feeling quite helpless. But once you can sort of understand what's going on and how difficult it is and the extent of injury and our very small role in it, it's actually a helpful way of realizing the situation and actually, you know, giving ourselves some credit in it and not feeling like we're not doing a good enough job. Because once you see what we're struggling against,
I mean, it can be difficult because how do we avoid sending them on to somebody else? How do we avoid doing that? What can we do for these types of patients?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that because I was giving a presentation on alcohol harms in GP on a study day for alcohol, and a GP trainee asked this question, and she said, "Well, you know, if we're not prescribing drugs to cover withdrawal," because we've been told we shouldn't do that and that's not safe. And if we're not the ones admitting for rehab and we're making sure that they are plugging into mutual aid, what is it that we do as GPs? You know, she was left feeling quite frustrated. And I didn't have a good answer at the time. And when I cycled home, I realized what the answer was. You know, and speaking to Dr. McCartney helped me realize that as well, is that, you know, first of all, our role is to ask about alcohol, to think about it. You know, people are going to present with all sorts of things that might not obviously be anything to do with alcohol. So we first of all got to bring it into the room, into the consultation. We've got to explicitly link it to symptoms for patients, you know, like, did you know alcohol is a major depressant on the brain? You know, some people will cure their depression just by stopping alcohol. And then we've got to kind of signpost to the right sources of support, but it's more than signposting. It's like signposting with conviction. You know, we're in this unique position as GPs. You know, we're not just a telephone operator. You know, we have this respect in people's lives. And if we say something like, the research shows that you're much more likely to succeed if you manage to plug into some recovery community, or did you know that there is a recovery activity planned every single day of the year here in Edinburgh, including Christmas Day? There's this huge community. It can be online or it could be in person. If we can sort of signpost, but with conviction, and really put a bit of us into it, that's something that we can do. And also holding the hope, you know, that feeling hopeless and feeling helpless is very much part of addiction and what's going on in your brain physiology. And so actually if we as GPs can hold a bit of hope, even when we're maybe privately feeling quite hopeless for the patient. But if we can demonstrate a bit of hope, then that in itself can be very powerful.
Yeah, fits with the value of general practice work we've been doing around how GPs have a huge amount of different types of skills and different areas to look at the whole human being and socially, psychologically, physically, because often there's physical problems that come along with this.
And I think being informed, you know, you mentioned there physically, like being informed about what happens in brain chemistry when someone's addicted, that, you know, alcohol, for example, dominates the dopamine reward system in an alcoholic. If we can explain that to people, that's very helpful. Like it's very helpful for someone to know that in early recovery, other things will not feel pleasurable because alcohol has dominated your reward system. And so, you know, going for coffee, going to the cinema, it's going to leave you feeling absolutely blah, nothing. But with time, as alcohol comes out of your reward system and the dopamine will start responding to other things, the things like that will start to give you pleasure. And actually, you'll be able to experience so many more different sources of pleasure once you come off alcohol, but it you have to go through the motions before that happens. Even being able to explain that little bit of brain chemistry and sort of give someone a bit of a forewarning about that, I think that's very helpful. So that kind of being informed is helpful.
I think often I say, well, I've been in this situation before with many different patients and I've seen people recover and give them a bit of hope around that. As well, so they don't feel as if they're the only person or hopeless, as you say, with these types of things.
Yeah. Can you think of, you know, patients from your career that, you know, did recover?
I can. I mean, it's. I was thinking about this earlier today, and as you were talking there, it's really this kind of situation can be difficult, challenging, and you can feel helpless yourself. But actually, if you spend a bit of time and you go through it, and I think if you listen, if you do empathize and actually see where they're coming from, you can usually understand where they are in their lives, and then think about how you can actually direct them and give them a bit of structure to begin to actually piece things back together again, because often they feel helpless or just overwhelmed. So I think listening and then it is about working with third sector organizations. We have a very good distress brief intervention service, link worker, and saying, let's, you know, work together, take it a step at a time. But the rehab a lot to offer in those terms as an anchor for them. And there's many patients I've known for many years who have come and gone with alcohol problems. And I can think of several particular cases where it's been tough, but actually it's very rewarding because you've stuck with them and then they've come out the other side of it. Which is what we do, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's what I, you know, the more curious I got about this, the more satisfaction I got from consults. For example, you know, I learned from speaking to one of the addictions nurses and from some of the SHAP research that patients actually find an over-focus on counting alcohol units very medicalizing, very depersonalizing. So although on one hand, we need to be literate in alcohol units, we need to be able to communicate that to patients. Actually, if we just sort of over-focus on that, it becomes counterproductive. And I was thinking about that and I had a patient in, you know, a few months ago and I had a 7-minute consult, as we all have, but I feel I achieved an awful lot more in that consult because I didn't actually go over how many units and da 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 da. I just said, how do you feel about your drinking yourself? And, you know, what do you think's at the base of it? And he looked a bit surprised to be asked these questions and he talked a little bit about it. And it kind of felt a bit transformational for both of us, you know. And of course, I'm still seeing him in and out of hospital, still struggling, but I felt that was a wee breakthrough moment that we had. And, it was still a 7-minute consultation. It was just a conversation, but I felt it was much more effective than how I was approaching it beforehand. And I think that thinking about how we can have these conversations better is the craft, isn't it, that we have?
It is the craft. It's the art of medicine and the consultation, which I find fascinating. I mean, we are doing a lot of work at the college around workforce and workload and those types of things. We're aware of the pressure on everybody. And we would all like more time with our patients, and we need to think about how we achieve that. But this is, it makes you us think about how we use the time we have and how effective that is.
When you were training, Chris, do you mind me asking, did you see it being done well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think role modelling is really, really important from trainers around how we don't dismiss and really listen and empathise with patients and understand and don't say this is a case of dementia, this is a case of depersonalising it. It's a human being behind it. And that's the strength of general practice in a way. And I think I've watched Fraser Richardson, who's a doctor now retired, who was just fantastic at that. So it's important to think about good examples of that and how we consult well. So, Rachel, thank you very much for that. That's a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot, as usual, as I do with these types of conversations, and I think it will really help me think through what we do in this type of situation. So really encourage people to go and listen to your podcast, which is Conversations About Alcohol.
Yes.
Which is really good. Is anything else you want to tell us about at the moment?
Well, there'll also be this webinar on CHURAS, which was designed for GP trainees, but I think it'll be open to everyone. And that's where I go over a little bit more the kind of statistical context of alcohol in Scotland, and then looking at the different types of patients that we see come to harm from alcohol, from the obvious, the more extreme examples that I gave before, to the much more less obvious, for example, when people come to discuss HRT and menopause and they're worried about their breast cancer risk because of their family history. You know, have we thought about asking about alcohol, which is actually a massive risk? And it also uses some multimedia interesting clips. Got permission from a journalist based in Glasgow to use a little bit of her BBC Panorama documentary called Binge Drinking and Me, which I would really recommend you watch. And that's a very youthful, professional look at how we have got into the situation of alcohol harm in Scotland and how it's part of our society. So, hopefully the webinar will be of interest, and the podcast is maybe even easier to listen to when you're walking your dog.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Generally Speaking, the RCGP Scotland podcast. Be sure to follow us on social media to stay up to date with all of the work and news from across the college.